Professional historians, I fear, have very few credentials to justify their presence at a conference concerning the future. We have a difficult enough time trying to understand the past, to say nothing of the future. We are, as professional people, like that classical Alaskan bird that always flew backwards to see where he had been. It is true that there have been a few bold souls, historians enamored of the social scientific aspects of their discipline, who have sought to make history a predictive, a kind of enterprise. But as my close associates will attest, I am not of that disposition myself. Prediction and prophecy are not my long suit. And yet, as an historian, I know that a study of human experience in the past may inform our understanding of the present and help thereby to order our priorities and our strategies as we move into the future. May inform, I say, because the record of historians who have turned to this enterprise is not terribly convincing. Some historians, and they most often have been popular historians like H.G. Wells, have no better record than other futurologists when it came to predicting or trying to project what the future might be like. Indeed, it is sobering to contemplate how very wide of the mark most futurologists in the past have been. The future, as things often turned out, has been a more like the past than most of the futurologists have found pleasing to their disposition. Chiefly, I think, the future has turned out to be more like the past because, however drastic the visions of the future may have been, they rested most often on very widely held and widely shared implicit, often covert assumptions and values. It was very difficult for anyone to break out of a paradigm, of a system, of viewing the world in a given way, so that the enterprise is kind of locked in. I think it is an extraordinarily difficult and sometimes a frivolous kind of enterprises. Values and assumptions, I think, enjoy such momentum that, like the Mississippi that rolls through this campus, these values and assumptions just keep rolling along. And what I wish to do in a moment is to attempt to set forth what some of those assumptions have been in the American experience, what force they still have, and therefore what implications they are likely to have for Metro 2000. First, however, if you will forgive me, a personal subjective note on the roots of my persisting skepticism about the enterprise of futurology. Way back in 1933, when I was but 12, a young boy from a small town, Blue Earth, as you heard, in southern Minnesota, never having visited a city larger than Mankato, I went with my family to the Great Chicago World's Fair, A Century of Progress. And I assure you, it was quite a traumatic experience, coming from the breadbasket of this continent to the streets of Chicago in 1933 in the summer. I saw young boys my own age singing, "Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?" and begging on the streets. My father took me to see Sally Rand. I learned much later that she always danced in body tights, but as I remember the occasion, the blue light was so dim that it would have been impossible to detect what she was wearing, if anything. But I do ask you to believe that it was a very moving event for a young boy. But more to the point of the future, and perhaps some of you went to that World's Fair, everywhere in the fairgrounds there were all those dramatic mock-ups of what the future would be like. There were little models and little dioramas, and whatever building one went in, usually there was some kind of a mock-up of what life would be like, I don't know, 25 or 40 or 50 years in the future. Always the vision, and from one place to another was always the same, was technological, with hardly ever a reference, of course, to cultural or social implications. I don't know how that could have been put in a diorama, but surely it was not. But I do remember so clearly the environment that was sketched forth. It was ordered, it was clean, uncluttered, and quiet. One could imagine a kind of lovely, subdued electronic hum as the tone that prevailed in such an environment. The streets had become parkways, and through these parkways and above the urban landscape hummed quiet little transportation capsules. You may remember them because they are still there, little contained aluminum, glass, and plastic gondolas, almost like little bananas, in which one sat and looked out. And I remember the little people reading newspapers as they went along. It was so quiet and so clean and so ordered and so lovely. But we're all being carried in these silly little gondolas as we zipped along to our destinations, whatever they might be. Well, even at age 12, that all seemed too sterile and too antiseptic for my taste. Much better Sally Rand, even with the dark blue lights. Well, since then, since 1933, I've visited other world's fairs, New York, Seattle, New York again, Montreal, and this summer the little mock-up in the Bicentennial exhibit in the IDS Tower here in Minneapolis, and always the environmental scenes, the future was the same. It is still the ordered little parkways and sedate little people standing about, and everybody zipping around in these funny little gondolas. The vision is the same, and yet when I go downtown St. Paul or Minneapolis, 42 years after 1933, we've got Nicollet Mall to be sure, and that's all to the good, but clumsy, smelly, gas-guzzling, noisy old buses and trucks and cars still carry us about. I won't believe in the future until someone comes around with a little aluminum banana for me to ride in. Well, that is the source of my skepticism. But more to the point, I spoke a moment ago about certain assumptions, certain values, certain perceptions that a society may hold, first principles, first axioms, that provide a kind of coherent guide both to individual behavior and to public policy. And these clusters of perceptions go to make up a kind of paradigm, a system of related perceptions, a system of looking at life and society and its possibilities that define a given culture, provide a certain dynamic for a culture, and at the same time set certain limits for what a given society may do. Over time, these perceptions, these assumptions are, of course, modified, they're amended, they change. Some parts are discarded, some parts are added. They're never static, they're always dynamic and growing and shifting and fluid. And yet they are also marked by a very profound continuity. And as I look back upon the sweep of the American experience from very early days down well into the mid-20th century, I see a certain cluster of values and principles, certain perceptions that have persevered, that had such momentum that they continue to mark the way we come at our own society, the way we perceive our role in that society, tend also to condition the perceptions that we have of the future as we try to play out and extend the kind of future that we might wish or the kind of future that we logically can expect. And it is these clusters of perceptions that I wish to address briefly this afternoon with you. Particularly, there are three. There are many more, but I think three that bear most directly on our consideration of Metro 2000. The first I would call property. The second, particularity or individualism. I say particularity just because it begins with a P. And finally, progress. I think a commitment to property, to individualism, and to progress have been constituted three very closely intertwined perceptions and value clusters which are with us still. And as you will note as I go along, so I may as well anticipate that now, I have a very strong feeling that these particular clusters of assumptions are inadequate to inform the kind of future probably that most of us want. And I think the task is to recognize what these values are, in what process of change they now are, and what we can do about it, if anything. So let us take each of them very briefly. First, the American devotion of property, to individual property, to private property. The root principle was Anglo-American, deeply ingrained in those Englishmen who removed themselves and came to this new continent, America. I suppose it found its most explicit statement in the commentaries of the great British jurist Blackstone in the 18th century, who, just on the eve of the American Revolution, he was English, set down in his commentaries the law in that Anglo-Saxon tradition, or as we saw it in America, the Anglo-American tradition, kind of summarized where things were in his generation and certainly earlier. One part of his commentaries was called The Law of Things. Nice, blunt, direct title for a chapter. And in that chapter that dealt with the law of things, he wrote, among other comments, and I'm going to quote very briefly, "There is nothing which so generally strikes the imagination and engages the affection of mankind as the right of property," which he then went on to define, and now I'm quoting again, "which is that sole and despotic dominion which one man claims and exercises over the external things of the world in total exclusion of the right of any other individual in the universe." Blackstone did not italicize, but I think we might. Dominion, there is a good old-fashioned word, dominion over. It is what the Lord told Adam and Eve to do with the earth, that they would have dominion over this natural universe. It set up at once an objective relationship between man and the earth, which meant that it had to be an exploitive relationship. I think this whole sense of property, of dominion over things of the world, is an exploitive kind of relationship. Dominion over property by the individual. And notice again the words, the soul and despotic. For I think Blackstone, without intending, he favored this kind of system, but surely there was implied in it a kind of despotism down the road. It was then on that fundamental assumption that Americans settled and exploited this land of such potential richness from sea to shining sea. It marked the rectangular pattern of settlement on the land. It marked the process by which, in a generation and a half, the forests were chopped down from the Atlantic to the Mississippi. Indeed, it was claimed in the 19th century that so thick was the forest that a squirrel could travel from Maine to Minnesota without ever touching the ground. And yet we know that by 1890, the squirrel would have to scurry along the ground because the trees, the great forests, were gone. Gone because they were chopped down for private profit by private entrepreneurs to satisfy the needs of an expanding urban society in the 19th century, but with hardly a thought for social planning, with hardly a thought for the needs of other generations. The forests were razed in very substantial part because the nation was devoted to that sole and despotic dominion over the resources of the earth, and that each individual who could claim that right held it exclusively without the intervention, without the guidance, without the modification of social controls of any sort. Well, so also with coal, iron, oil, soil. I think it is in the same spirit today that we strip the fragile soils of the Great Plains, Montana, Wyoming, the Dakotas, destroying forever the natural pastures and grazing lands there in order to gobble up the coal that lies just below the surface. It seems to me that there is the same persisting kind of recklessness, same kind of despotism, if you wish, in that enterprise today. Now, of course, in time, government at every level came to extend and modify this system in some ways, but I think it is safe to say as a generalization, to which there are some exceptions, but not many, that more often the government intervened to promote that system, a system of rapid and efficient private exploitation of natural resources, many of them non-renewable as now we know, than it did to guarantee that a broad social interest would be protected. As I look at the way in which cities developed in the 19th and 20th century, without pattern, without thought, without participation of the people who were living in them, I think we can see in the squalor and the sprawl, for there is much of that in modern urban America, the same kind of expression. And it seems to me that if we move into Metro 2000 with other values in mind, that somehow we have to come to terms with the implications of this deeply ingrained tradition in the economic and social system of this country. Related to this first principle of property was a second, a kind of extravagant individualism that found its expression in national psychology, in culture and family, in customs and habits of all sorts. There was fostered a kind of particularistic view of society. It was a kind of mechanical view of society as being composed of an aggregate of separate parts. A view of society then that was more mechanical than organic. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, we declared in 1776. And then in the Constitution, in the great Fifth Amendment, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, and property without a due process of law. Another revolution in that generation pronounced liberty, equality, fraternity. But I think in America it has been safe to say that an organic sense of community, a fraternity to put it in the revolutionary terms of the 18th century, the sense of the community of being composed of interrelated parts, mutually interdependent, one with the other, has never been particularly strong in this country. And I think, again, as I look at the city of the 19th, the 20th century, that this particularism is still evidenced. It's related, I think, to the despotism of property. I think that it is, however, worthy of consideration as a separate observation. Property, particularism, and progress. For Americans have believed above all else that human history was linear and that human history was beneficent, that progress could be weighed and measured in physical and material terms. And this society believed, crucially, that human happiness would flow from progress measured by such materialistic criteria. Big was better, more was best. Affluence meant power. Power was translated into national power, which could be exercised to make this country number one, as though history were some kind of a hockey contest or World Series. And always the faith in technology linked to this belief in progress, a faith in technology and science and technology to solve all problems of production and to resolve all problems of society. And if it went far enough, I suspect that's where it came. The utopia of zipping around in little plastic gondolas. But now, in our own day, I think we have come to question these and a number of related values. The store of traditional energy resources, we learned, was not infinitely expandable, but finite and rapidly running out. More and more people on planet Earth consuming at ever higher levels, raise questions of survival. And the tragic events in Southeast Asia in our own lifetime demonstrated that even the power of number one could be contained, and that American motives were not invariably benign. Extravagant forms of individualism, which exalted competition over cooperation, I believe subverted community needs and left millions of citizens vulnerable to great consolidations of economic and political power. Well, so what of Metro 2000? What of our Twin Cities in a quarter century? Simply this, well, I really should say complexly this, except I have 5 minutes instead of 5 hours. I think our world is being rapidly transformed by an acceleration of historical forces over which it is profoundly difficult to impose even the most modest controls. Two lines, particularly, I fear, will define our opportunities on planet Earth the next quarter century, and that means the Twin Cities as part of the planet Earth, because our fate is that of the planet. There's no way to isolate any metropolis at all. One of those lines is the upward soaring exponential curve of population. We see it so much, we dismiss it with a shrug of our shoulders. And yet it is salutary, I think, to recall that it took down to 1830, from the beginning of human life, whenever that was, whenever we came out of the trees, way eons ago, it took from that beginning down to 1830 to get 1 billion people living on Earth at one time. The second billion came in precisely a century, sometime in the decade of the 1930s, the Earth supported 2 billion. The third billion came in a single generation, in the mid-1960s, 30, 35 years, the third billion. We are told that the fourth billion, if these curves are projected without catastrophe, and one doesn't pray for catastrophe, that the fourth billion will come in the mid-1980s. Well, I think this is, if you plot that curve, and you've seen it so often again, I say we tend to dismiss it. I think it has implications for Metro 2000 as one of tens of thousands of such crowded assemblies of human population around the planet Earth. The other curve is a downward plunging curve, marking the reservoir of fossil fuels which have been the chief energy source to propel and feed the world in the modern era. Now it may be, and those who believe in progress will shrug and say, well, science will find a way out. We will get a new source of energy. And indeed, some scientists, as you've heard in other sessions of Metro 2000, have been working toward this. But it strikes me that the time is running out, that we don't have a great deal of time to confront this problem, and yet I don't see this society or other societies setting the kind of priority which I think is essential to make an adjustment to an entirely different energy system. And I think that we have not made that adjustment, in part because of this long traditional optimistic faith in progress and our commitment to private property. Against these crude facts, the value system that I've been talking about seems to me no longer fully appropriate. The values we hold dear, the perceptions by which we act, the strategies by which we set priorities, condition in very large measure the processes by which we plan our social and physical and cultural environment. And until the very recent past, America has stressed these clusters of values. It is true in the Twin Cities as in Dallas or New York or Missoula. And my question this afternoon, and I have no answers, is by what process can a new paradigm be shaped? Based on cooperation rather than competition? Based on organic rather than on mechanical principles? Can this society or any society accept limits to growth? If we accept limits of growth, what implications are there for material standards of living and the whole environment, social, cultural, physical, of the metropolis in 25 years? Can we move toward a definition of property relationships which will encourage citizen participation in the planning of neighborhoods and the creation of a shared urban community? Can we evolve systems for the delivery of health services that will maximize well-being and transcend our persisting preoccupation, which I think is a reflection of this particularism, with intensely individualistic, heroic forms of medicine? We can invest millions of dollars in keeping a few lives alive beyond, I will say, a reasonable point. Somehow we cannot deliver to the neighborhood the kinds of medical services that a people need. Can we learn to live comfortably with our environment and with ourselves without rushing suicidally as we have in the past, faster and faster towards more and more? Well, as I say, I do not know. I'm not a predictor nor a prophet. Rather, my purpose has been more modest, merely to suggest that the beliefs that people hold make a difference, both in their own behavior and in the shaping of public policy. To suggest that traditional assumptions, to me, seem no longer adequate for the last quarter of the 20th century. To suggest that the shape of Metro 2000 will relate to technology, to the force of massive historical events, and to the kinds of values and perceptions we evolve. But who knows? In the year 2000, I will be 79. I should live so long. And it may be that I will be carried to my final resting place in a quietly humming, enclosed, shiny aluminum gondola. Thank you.